Yo, 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 Energy Fam, what the fuck going on? Welcome back to Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. It's been quite some time, it's been about a month since the last episode. I do apologize for my lack of appearance, but I have been busy. I've been busy, guys. Phase 2 is almost up and running. There's been a lot of activity here at Primal Alchemy HQ, trying to get shit together, ready to launch what I believe to be the ultimate health and fitness brand in the world. It's not really a health and fitness brand. It's a superhuman optimization brand. There's no one else out there doing this, and the new products that I've got ready to come out are honestly, guys, next fuck level compared to anything out on the market. So it's just taken me a little bit of time, and I haven't been able to commit to getting these podcasts out like I promised. But if all goes according to plan, moving into September, we're back to one episode a week. And then as we progress into October, we'll be back into episodes a week. You guys work as fuck per usual. So again, guys, I just want to use this opportunity to say thank you for sticking with on this process. Really does mean the world to me. Every bit of feedback you guys give to me, be it on YouTube, be it on iTunes, be it on Instagram, where you hit me up on the DMs, really does mean the world. And I love being able to connect with you and have discussions with you guys. Each and every one of you that reach out to me, I will get back to you. I will definitely do my best to be able to open gauge with you, and yeah, we've all got shit to from each other, so don't think it's a one-way street, just you listening to me, that's it. Like if you guys reach out to me, I'll do everything I can in order to give you some airspace and see what you've got to say. And yes, please, as always, drop me a review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Cast, YouTube, Instagram. Let me know what your thoughts are. Let me know what topic you want to hear, and who your favorite researchers are. Or actually, another good idea, guys, just on top of my head. If you're listening to any podcasts apart from the Red Pill Initiation Hour, and think that I would be a good guest on that podcast, please, the same, reach out to that podcast host and tell them about me. Like, I want to get my message out there just as much as anyone else. And yeah, you know, this podcast, I like to have it as like an open conversation with my... But again, I can't go in deep on the shit I like to talk about without a guest falling asleep. So yeah, let any of your podcast hosts that you listen to know that I'm open for the hookup, and I'm ready to take people down the rabbit if they want me on. So yes, take note of that, guys. As always, exclusive to 10% code for primalalchemyco.uk. That code REDPILL. That's the code REDPILL that when used at checkout, you get 10% off anything with your shopping basket. Which very soon will be hopefully quite a wide spectrum of products in that shopping basket as we step into the next chapter of the Primal Alchemy brand. Anyway, guys, moving on to today's guest, which is Mr. John Roman. Now, John, fitness expert, creator of the Roman Fitness Systems Alpha 2.0, his book, which is a great for all you guys out there, look at Alpha the fuck up. And I'll be honest with you guys, this was a bit of a different podcast than I was expecting. I was getting John on to discuss his methodologies to increase testosterone. I have a little bit of bro talk about weight training, fitness in general, and we ended up the whole fucking conversation about polyamory, which again is a very interesting subject, and one seems to be getting a little bit of a spike shown on it in especially in the social media realm. And I find this an incredibly insightful conversation between myself and John. It was really good getting his perspective on things that today's world, generally speaking, this is quite a taboo subject. We've mentioned for a long time. It's a monogamous conditioning thing that, well, you know, guys, I always ramble on in the fucking intro and end up giving away the whole podcast. So I'm just gonna let you have a listen. Let me know what you think. get back to myself or John with your thoughts. Both of us would really appreciate the fact, as this is something for John as well. They'll discuss this sort of stuff. And yeah. So, guys, other than that, enjoy the show. As always, yes. Tell these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below, what lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual. We find balance with all three as we focus on totality. The whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path. Looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar. As we go deep down to the molecular level, tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use the nature to heal. With a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal. And your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self-mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey, but we up to empower with this red pill initiation hour. With this red pill initiation hour, brought to you by Primal Alchemy.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, a two, and a one, and oh shit, guys, we're back. Praise Odin, praise Osiris. We're here, episode 55 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour, and today, this is gonna be an interesting one, guys. You know by now that I'm here trying to fly the flag for modern day alphaness. What is the real deal when it comes to being a 21st century male and the roles that have been assigned to us? Some have been forced upon us, some come natural, and today we're going to sort of really hit home the truth of what it means to be an alpha male and really embody the divine masculine. So any females that are listening, this isn't for you to be put off by this. This is even a great chance for you to check out where, well, if your partner lives up to the checklist that we're about to drop, or even if you're searching for a partner and you're looking for some signs for that perfect somebody to unify your own divine femininity with. So, yeah, today's guest is Mr. John Romanello. He is the creator of Roman Fitness Systems. He is the author of, Engineering Alpha, Man 2.0, just to name a few of the other books as well. And he is now recently turned to being a writing coach and a business mentor based out in New York. Is that right, John? You're out in New York?
I am indeed in the greatest city on earth.
Yes. Oh, God. I don't know about that one, John, but
I don't think it's a debate. What would be the other options on the list?
Well, New York City would definitely be in the top 20 for me. I wouldn't put it in the top 10. I would say... Are you not bad? Okay, I'm just gonna throw this out here. This is gonna be a real shot in the dark. 3, 2, 1, bang! Denver.
Why Denver?
Good shout, man. I don't know. I really like the vibe there. I did a journey across stateside. Drove from Boston to LA about a year ago, and I just like the vibe over there. I like it because it's like a mountain town, but it's big, it's got big city feel to it, but people just seem a little bit more chill there. Maybe it's just because I haven't made it in New York. Maybe that's why.
I would wow, this is very interesting. Yeah, you don't normally hear people who are not from the States say Denver.
Yeah. Mate. All right. I'm a bag of surprises. I will definitely shock a few. But Denver, or if we're not going stateside, I'm going, there is, what are we classing the best city as? Like, what are the requirements?
I guess that is really the subjective part of it. But for me, the thing that makes New York the greatest city on earth is it has immense historical significance with the with regard to its importance in the American Revolution, which obviously does not seem ostensibly to mean as much to people who are not American. But when you consider the position that the United States has occupied as one of the world's foremost superpowers of the past 200 some odd years, and how that was really inculcated from the original victory in terms of separating from Great Britain, and how the government that was created thereof really set the precedent for pretty much all republics and or democratic republics since then. I think that's very important. There's also the fact that it is the center of media, the center for commerce, the guiding point for culture in many respects. And I think that if you begin to break culture down into categories and rate them on a scale of 1 to 10, whether it is food or fashion or fitness or architecture or commerce or finance, education, you will see that when you start comparing all other cities, New York might not get a 10 out of 10 in every category, but it will consistently score close to the highest across all categories. And so you can do, one of the things that I love is the convenience. I don't always want to order a steak from a 4-star or 5-star restaurant at 3 a.m, but I like having the option. There's nothing I can't do in New York. I am an hour from the beach, less than an hour from the beach by train. I can take a drive up to the Hudson Valley and be in the mountains. I can go skiing. I can go snow. It's everything that most people would want to have, you can access in New York. It is also a city of hustlers. You really do need to be particularly gritty and dedicated and intelligent to survive here. When you contrast it to LA, and I don't have anything against LA. I think it's a great city for a certain type of person. LA is pretty much the dumbest, hottest person in everyone's graduating class who moved to Los Angeles thinking they were going to be an entertainer, an actor, whatever. And now, having not made it, they are working as personal trainers or in food service, and they're very bitter about it. And so they are bad at their jobs. But because LA is a city that focuses so heavily on appearance, you're allowed to be bad at your job in LA. What I notice is that every waiter who is bad at their job is reporting to a manager who is bad at their job. And the manager just kind of lets it happen, because it's easier to just have a shitty waiter on your staff than to simply be a good manager and go out and deal with hiring and firing and the whole thing. And that's really not allowed. I'm gainsaying, and I can't do that. But broadly, New York is a place where everyone has to be good at their job, and everyone is really incentivized to be here by this sense of great pressure to succeed. And
Whereabouts in New York are you based? Are you based in Manhattan?
I am. Yes. Yeah. So I live on the west side of Manhattan in an area that is rapidly developing. It's been all over the news lately. So I'm on the border of Hell's Kitchen, which is a very old neighborhood, and Hudson Yards, which is a brand new neighborhood that has literally just been opened on March 15th. So it's all these great new buildings, residential, commercial, and it's a neighborhood that was built over an existing rail yard. And so it's a historic part of Manhattan that to this point had never really had anything worthwhile there. It was a train yard. It was storage, more or less. And now it's been built over the past 6 or 7 years, and it's just open, and it's going to continue to develop. And so it's been really interesting to watch the skyline of the city change, the culture of the city change in real time from a front row seat here in my apartment. And I love the city. I think it's amazing. And I think to close on this topic, everyone should love a place as much as I love New York. And wherever that place is for you, I hope you go there. I hope you find it. I hope you live there. I love the fact that New York does not give a shit about me. It is one of the cases where if we step back objectively and realize our own significance, Gotham City would survive without Batman, but Batman would die very quickly without Gotham. He needs it. It's very much a part of his identity. And I really and truly think that for me, New York is home. It's where I'm from. And for anyone who is looking to experience New York in a real way, if you ever come, if you decide to come, if you're going to visit New York, at the end of this podcast, we'll talk about where you can find me, what you can learn about me. My Instagram handle is just @JohnRomanello. If you're going to come to New York, shoot me a DM and ask me what to do, where to go. Don't do tourist stuff. Don't go to the Empire State Building. Don't go to the Statue of Liberty. Experience New York as New Yorkers do. Please stay the fuck away from Times Square. Go down to the Village. I'll tell you where you can get a great drink, a great cocktail, a great burger. Experience New York through its food, through its people, through the vibes. And it is a place that takes on an entirely different personality and texture when you live here or you're staying for an extended period of time, particularly with a local, rather than when you visit. When people think of New York, they see giant buildings and, you know, advertising everywhere. And there are places in New York that are not at all like that in the city. There are places in the Village that are like low brownstones and old tenements and history and food and wonder. And I highly encourage anyone who is considering living anywhere else in the world, if you can afford to live here, if you can find a way to make it, spend a year here. It'll change your life.
Damn you. Yeah, that was a good sell. You should be a sales rep for New York. That's great. I was in New York last year doing, I stayed in Astor. Is that a place?
Astoria.
I was staying there with a friend and we went to Cat's Deli. Is that a place?
Yeah, Cat's Deli.
Yeah, really loved that, man. Have one of those pastrami sandwiches and I was like, mm-hmm. Oh shit, this is next level here. They're not, mm-hmm. They don't fuck around with these sandwiches. They know how to make some good pastrami. So anyway, yeah, man, before we make this whole podcast over New York. But can you give us a little bit of a rundown about who you actually are, please? That would be that would be great, John.
I am a writer, author, New York Times bestselling author, and business consultant living and working in New York City. Most people who know my internet presence are aware of me from my initial work in the fitness space. I was one of the first big online fitness personalities, or at least one with a seven-figure business. I was a personal trainer in New York, started a company called Roman Fitness Systems, and then in 2009, I brought it online and built a content site that was very well received because of the quality of the content, certainly, but also the quality of the writing and the messaging and the personal branding. Became one of the very first, very successful online coaches and had a business where I was working with people around the world. And that was a great joy to me in so many ways and created info products. And then in 2013, released a book that you mentioned earlier called Engineering the Alpha, A Real World Guide to an Unreal Life through HarperCollins. It was successful for what we needed it to do in terms of it having been purchased that acquisition for, or acquired at auction for $1.2 million, and which was a very large advance and got a lot of buzz, and debuted at number four on the New York Times bestseller list. I am very, very fortunate in my network and am able to run with a certain crowd of other bestselling authors, from Tim Ferriss to Tucker Max to Ryan Holiday to Neil Strauss, and they have been absolutely instrumental in helping me develop my career. My entrepreneurial journey has taken me from fitness guy to business coaching and consulting. I've done a lot of angel investing for companies, both directly tied to fitness and very distant from it. And these days, my work in terms of writing is about personal branding, writing itself. I teach a lot of people how to write. And then I also write a lot about everything from personal development, particularly through the lens of mental health and sex positivity, and relationships. And then the other business that I run is called Wellspring Media, through which I teach people how to find their voice and use it to create real effective personal branding that can allow them to monetize their existing businesses by creating the kind of content they want about the kind of thing they want to discuss in the way that feels authentic to them. And so it is a great joy to be able to help people do that. And that's kind of where we are. So in 2019, I build businesses and I help people write, and I do not do nearly as much with fitness today.
Going off that, I'm going to flip the switch a little bit, because that's actually really interesting. And I want to kind of pursue what you were just saying then, John. So one of the things to do with the Primal Alchemy brand is everything with what alchemy represents, which is the transmutation of a base metal into gold. It's from an alchemical perspective, it's taking your base level consciousness, your lead, in transmutating it into gold using your experiences as the chemicals in which you kind of mix within the cauldron of your body to perfect your soul. And obviously from there, kind of breaking that down, what I'm really in the game of is helping people become the best version of themselves on the pursuit of self-mastery. And it seems like you're on a very similar page as myself. And what is, in your opinion, what's some of the biggest setbacks that you find from people that come to you asking for your help and your expertise? Like, what's the sort of common theme, the common thread in the, you can take this from a personality type, or you can take this from just, what is it that people seem to, what's the thorn in people's sides, like the most predominant thorn that you see on average?
The largest impediment to personal mastery is a lack, or to self-mastery, is a lack of self-awareness about their lack of self-awareness. So it's very meta. Most people are not nearly as self-aware as they think they are. And without being able to objectively audit or take inventory about the various things holding you back, it's difficult to address them. And we are inherently sort of lazy in that, and we want to find ways to fix things without really taking them apart and seeing why they're broken, even if we know what's broken. And so this leads us into some pretty dark places, and we get involved in following the line of thinking for a lot of shoulds. Should is a very dangerous word. And, you know, even when you start looking at the word alpha or discussions of masculinity, it's men should know how to do this, should, you know, and those things are, they're presented as objectivity, but they're entirely subjective, and they come from the perspective of the person saying them, and buying into someone else's ideology is, without first, you know, really digging into it and examining it and seeing if it feels right for you ethically, emotionally, developmentally, or in terms of what you want to see, you know, created in the world, that you wind up spinning your wheels a lot and wasting a lot of time. The journey to self-discovery is really, before you can go anywhere, you have to dig in and know what your starting points are. And that is the big thing. I think most people that I have worked with, or with most people with whom I have real deep experience, they don't really know where they're starting. And we allow ourselves to operate from a position of ignorance with regard to our own decision-making matrices. And we believe, I think most of us like to believe, particularly men in my experience, that we are logical creatures. But what's really happening is we have these deep-seated beliefs that are founded on early experiential information and this, you know, a skewed data set. And this emotionality is the place of our decision-making impetus. And we push that impetus through this complex web of cognitive, emotional, psychological, and social biases. And so we get to these conclusions where we don't really know why we hold the positions that we hold, or why we do the things that we do. And it creates some real difficulty with growth.
Are most of the people that come to you for help, is there a majority percentage of male or female, or is it mixed? What's your sort of clientele look like?
For the writing instruction, it's pretty mixed. I work with a lot of women, more so than I did with other stuff. In the fitness coaching, historically, my readership was more male. And in general, I would say my readership skews very heavily toward male, but the people who actually pull the trigger and wind up hiring me are split pretty evenly, which is nice. So, you know, you have maybe 30% of the population in terms of my readership being women, doing at least 50% of the mentorships. So there's a lot there. And I think that putting out the type of content or taking the type of positions that I do makes women feel very safe to work with me. And that is something I take very seriously. And also I think there's, you know, because of the way that we're socialized women feel a little bit safer asking for help and seeking coaching or consulting than men do. In general, men are socialized to believe that they can do it themselves, that they don't need help. And I just want to point out that I'm being very intentional with my language, because when I say men are socialized to believe something, I am really making the case that men, an individual man existing in a vacuum, is not more likely to have an aversion to asking for help than a woman in a similar situation. It's growing up and being raised in the culture of hypermasculinity, or of this idea that showing weakness makes you weak, that asking for help is a sign of that weakness. So I don't like to say things like men are less likely to ask for help or men don't want help, because that implies a certain level of indelibility or inherence to that quality, which I don't think is the case. I think it's very much a matter of having been socialized in a certain way. And that type of socialization is the first thing to unravel before we can help anyone. And in our own self-development, we need to first figure out how many of these beliefs feel truly authentic to me versus how much am I just agreeing with in terms of these invisible scripts that run because of the movies that I watch and the way the world tells me I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. And that's really what I wanted to get onto next, is the sort of, yeah, like you said, like the social program and the social constructs that are in place to really create a male, a sort of a cookie cutter shaped male moving out into the world. And it creates a very imbalanced male at that. We have set beliefs of how a male should operate within the world and how they should respond to the world, and their reactions should be preset. And it's very interesting that in today's age there seems to be a resurgence of a sort of a new generation of males that are sort of coming through in loads of different industries. I don't know if that's a direct call, a direct answer to previous generations of, you could call it the shadow masculinity that has kind of really played havoc on the world, which is then, in my opinion, given rise to what we see now within the case of extreme feminism, which I believe is a direct answer to the shadow masculinity that's in the world. And then the only way to combat that is for the divine masculine to resurface. And from there, once the divine masculine resurfaces, then it allows females to be at ease and sort of really dial in to their divine femininity. And one of the things that I know that you are quite the expert on, as you were saying with your book of Engineering the Alpha, what is your opinion, John, in terms of the characteristics of a true 21st century alpha?
I have a complicated relationship with that word. You know, when you name your book Alpha, when you put that in there, you really sort of open yourself up to a lot of slings and arrows. And there are so many people who did not read the book, and it creates a certain association between me and my personal brand and that word. What I really wanted to do with Alpha is reclaim it and redefine it. The issue with the idea of the alpha male is that we use it from a sort of pack mentality, right? So an alpha being the alpha male of a group, the highest ranking member of a given set. Mm-hmm. And the issue there is that it is comparative analysis. You are only here, and that only means something good because of the people who are below you. And it's very small-minded. So what I wanted to do with that book is really create a conversation around self-development and trying to be the best version of yourself. But I am a very vocal and ardent feminist in that I believe in equalitarianism. I believe that everybody should have the same opportunities. If people aren't willing to admit that there is a gender pay gap, that there is institutionalized racism, that there is this institutional inequality, that it is harder for people of color, for women to advance. Like it's not my job to convince them. I just acknowledge that those things are true. But for me, my goal isn't to help men become more manly men. It's to help men with that book. It's just people who happen to be men become better people. And so I don't really focus on maximizing masculinity. I focus more on cultivating capability. My goal is to help people find a way to navigate through the world in a way that is going to lead to greater success for them without taking things or hurting other people. And because they themselves have greater success, they will ideally be in a better position to operate from a place of service. And with those qualities, it's about, you know, confidence is having an objective understanding of what your skills are, both your strengths and your weaknesses. It is not feeling ashamed of your weaknesses. It is saying, all right, I am good at, just to break it down to like school subjects, I am very, very good at language and history, but I'm very bad at math. And so I don't have to feel ashamed about being at math. I can make the decision. Is that something that I want to work on? Is it a quality that I wish to develop? Or can I acknowledge it within myself, get to a place of acceptance, and then seek out people in my life who are good at that, and they can be good at the things I'm bad at. And as I build my tribe and my community and my family and my team for business or for life, it's like playing Dungeons and Dragons. There are the people who use magic. There are people who are good at bows and arrows. There are the people who can get up front and start swinging big swords. And every single one of those people is just as important. But the thing is, you need to ask yourself, am I okay with not being good at everything? And if you're not, how can I get there? Because you can't be amazing at everything. And so it's confidence without moving into cockiness, which is usually just an inversion of insecurity. It is wanting to be helpful and help people achieve what they set out to do without taking it from them and saying like, I'll do it better. I'll just do it for you, because then you deprive people the right to grow. It is being proud of your appearance and wanting to put forth effort into the way that you look, because you have an understanding that the world perceives you a certain way based on that. And but without thinking that, you know, you have to recognize it's this crazy thing that we need to recognize that as human beings operating in Western society, our entire experience of our own lives would be very different if we looked a different way. I happen to be a very handsome guy. I'm not saying that egotistically, I'm not being vain about it, but just when you like look at the qualities of what we assess as what makes an attractive man, I happen to fall on the right-hand side of the bell curve for the Western beauty standard. I have been paid to have pictures of myself taken, people react well to me, etc. If I had been born with a different bone structure, if my eyes were further apart or closer together, if my teeth were different, if my jaw was smaller, or my chin was smaller, or my nose was larger, whatever the various makeup of the recipe for this, if it had been tweaked a certain way, and I were not on the far right-hand side of the bell curve, but I were squarely in the middle, my entire experience of life would be different. I would not have people react to me the way that I do. It would not be as easy for me to get the kind of work that I have. People, you know, it would not be easy for me to date as effectively, et cetera. So these things are just objective facts that we have to realize. And so it's okay, obviously, to acknowledge that you're handsome. Or, you know, but that doesn't mean that people who are not, that are not conventionally attractive are worse than you. And so it's not even that we operate from this place of thinking that we're better because we're good looking or muscular or wealthier or smarter. It's that the people who are not feel less than. And how can we exist within this paradigm of acknowledging these things that we had absolutely nothing to do with achieving without it making anyone else feel lesser or in lack because they probably have so many characteristics that, and qualities that in a different societal setup would make them infinitely more suited to success. And that even within the context of our current societal setup, probably make them very, very suited for success in very specific mediums. So are they likely to be models? Possibly not, but in what world does that actually fucking matter? And so we really have to figure out like what things are. It's a matter of looking at things just with pure objectivity to the extent that we can and detaching from them emotionally. And so for me, being the alpha version of myself and encouraging people to be the alpha version of themselves is to have a real understanding of how they exist in themselves and how they feel about that, not worrying about being better looking than someone else or not being as good looking as someone else. It is, you know, it's taking charge of your development without thinking that leveling up in any one of these areas makes you a better person or a more worthwhile person than someone who can't get to that level or who has not yet done that.
Pretty good answer, John. Pretty good answer. I was, that was good breakdown, dude. And I'm on a similar page, like in terms of what my definition of the alpha is. Have you read King, Warrior, Magician, Lover?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an amazing book by Robert Moore. And that's one of the books that, and The Way of the Superior Man is by
Data,
those two books have really helped, create a foundation of the way that I sort of live my life when it comes to how I project my masculinity onto the world. Like I try to be the king of my own kingdom without letting the shadow dictator take control of selfish desires and projecting my needs onto other people. Getting in touch with the creative force within me to be able to manifest my reality that I dream of. And yeah, just having that warrior courage to be able to pursue your dreams. And I feel, again, the one that ties it all together, which is the lover. And I think that's one of the core archetypes that it's hard for males to really embody in today's age, because it requires some vulnerability, because you have to put yourself out there to show love to another person. And yeah, you have to be open for rejection. And that love doesn't have to be a romantic love. It can just be an unconditional love for just another human being. And like you said, it doesn't matter if they're attractive, unattractive. It's just human to human, unconditional love. And that is what I believe is the key to tying the other archetypes together. And it's a practice. It's a practice of cultivation, of developing these archetypes within you. And in order to do those, in order to practice those, embody those, and to really gain from those archetypes, you have to go through your own sort of daily microcycle with the hero's journey. And that's another sort of core underpinning structure of my day-to-day life, in which I feel if you follow that through, I know you're familiar. I've heard you talk about the hero's journey on, I believe it, you mentioned it briefly when you're talking to Anthony DiClemente on Biohacking Secrets show. Yep. Yeah. How influential is the hero's journey and Joseph Campbell's work been for you?
I wrote my thesis on the hero's journey and Campbell in school. So pretty yeah. And so, I've been working on a hero's journey book for about 5 years. It's my white whale. At some point I'll finish it, but there are so many things that have happened in my personal life, my personal development, where I have kind of stepped back and been very thankful that I didn't finish the book or that I didn't release the book, because there are so many things that came from a place of not having as great an understanding of myself or of what made me at the time that I had been doing the writing. And so right now I'm very much dedicated to self-discovery, and I will revisit the book in a couple of years. But Campbell, the Hero's Journey, the monomyth, formed the structural basis for Engineering the Alpha. We took the reader through a transformative journey. But I believe that it's really the it's applicable as an overlay to any great change we go through in our lives, whether it is starting a business, leaving a job, getting divorced, having a child. We all begin in our current situation of the ordinary world, and we have thresholds that we need to cross to get into the next level, and guardians that we need to slay to get there. We have allies that help us along the way. And over the time, I think it's not possible to go through any great sort of physical change or mental change or professional change without undergoing some sort of emotional shift to who you are, psychologically and spiritually. And what we often miss in discussions of the hero's journey is that unless there's an awareness there, unless there's an intentionality there, it is possible to go through these big changes and come out worse if we're using better and worse as words to describe a person. And, you know, whatever those mean qualitatively, I tend to say worse in terms of you are more likely to make decisions that make you and other people around you unhappy and don't serve the world as effectively and take you further from your mission of self-mastery and service. And then better would be the opposite of that. Better is you are more self-aware. You have greater understanding of who you are and the things you need to and want to achieve. You have a greater likelihood of making decisions that are in line with your espoused desires. And overall, you are more equipped and dedicated to and prepared for service to the world. So that is my definition of worse and better, respectively. So it's something that we miss when we discuss the hero's journey. We forget that you can undergo this hero's journey. You can come out on the other side. You can kill Voldemort, or you know, you can destroy the Emperor, and then you can take his seat. You can, you know, fall victim to, you know, your shadow self. And so The way that we prevent that is constant vigilance, self-assessment, auditing, and having the people around us who are intimately aware of who we are. And these are our friends, our family, our lovers, because those people are the only people close enough to you to see how you interact in your day to day. They like live in the house of your life. You know, most people are our guests in the home that we create in our life, right? When they're going to come over, we clean up, we put the laundry away, we close the cabinets. But those deepest relationships that we have in our life, they live with us in the palace of our experience of the world. And they know if we leave the towels on the floor, and they can call us out on that. And so having, you know, one of the most important things that we can do is continue to invest in and cultivate intimate relationships with other people dedicated to self-mastery. And that tribal community has to work on the premise that people can, without fear, call each other out on the things they need to work on. And that is like the definition of an ally, someone who is going to stand up both for you and, when necessary, stand against you and say, this is not in line with who I know that you want to be. And the only way that people know that is if they know you well enough to have that subjective and objective sort of template. And that requires real intimacy and vulnerability. So cultivating those relationships and building that community is one of the foundational principles for me for becoming a better person.
Yeah, sure. But in order to find the quality of ally that you're referring to, you have to be on the journey. You have to have responded to your call to adventure, be whatever that is in your life, and you have to have stepped out of the ordinary world into the extraordinary. And then that's where you're going to find these characters, that's where you're going to find these people that enter your life very synchronistically. And yeah, they are there for a reason. They are there to be able to join your party, to go on side quests with, XP, level up, and to learn and grow with. And one of the things I'm interested to know of you, John, is what's the sort of pivotal milestones in your life, if you were to sort of overlay the hero's journey onto your own life, where you've seen the most like milestones of like growth potential occur?
You asking for specific events?
Yeah, just in your own life. Like, when have you seen the biggest sort of metamorphosis, the biggest change within your own character?
The past year has been massively transformative, and it's so much is concomitant with delving into my childhood sexual trauma, unraveling that, accepting that it happened, and really working through all the ways that it set me down a certain path in terms of the way that I conduct myself and the fear that I have, fear of abandonment, fear of unworthiness. And there have been moments where I destroyed romantic relationships, sabotaged things, just like started fights that I didn't need to, because I was afraid to do the work, because I had great fear of diving in. You know, as Campbell says, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. And once I became aware of this sexual trauma, it had been repressed for 26 years or so. Once I became aware of it, I was terrified of it. I did not want to enter that cave. And anytime things were like smooth in my life, I would find a way to blow something up, because then I would have to be putting things back together, fixing relationships, I'd be busy with a side quest instead of just strapping on my sword and going into the cave. And that is a type of, it's one of these things where action can be avoidant, and where the quest for knowledge can be a type of procrastination. And there is this familiarity of existing with a wound that becomes so ingrained in who you are that the idea of not having it is foreign. You don't know who you are without this thing. And so healing it is crazy. It's this terrifying thing. And the past year of my life, having gotten to the point where I was, I think it's true that the only way something with anything big, with anything like deeply seated and emotional, rooted in spirit, the only time you change is when the pain of staying the same is too great. And I had a number of those points, and now having done enough of the work to be constantly visiting that cave every week and doing, that's the big thing. That has been, it is one of, for the last year, unraveling and addressing sexual trauma and all of the ways that it created patterns and just, and operated as this like demon living in my head who controlled me from a place of destruction. That has been one of the primary pillars of my life for the past year. And so that is a huge moment. And then another one, which happened a little bit earlier, but didn't really, it's gotten more concretized over the past year or so, is just fully discussing my mental health and even having this conversation with you. We've never spoken before. We're on this podcast and I'm like, oh, let's talk about my childhood rape, at least in a roundabout way. Like getting to that point has been huge in terms of mental health and acceptance. And then the third pillar is really understanding myself in terms of my sexuality, in terms of understanding that I am, my sexual alignment is and is never going to be monogamous, but polyamorous, and being openly in a relationship that is polyamorous with a person who has a very big following and is announcing these things to, we're constantly courting this resistance, and that allows me to overcome resistance. And I'm doing a lot of boss battles this year, a lot of levels up.
Shit, man. Yeah. Oh, fuck. Sorry.
No worries.
That was really interesting, real interesting insight from, I always love sort of digging deep into someone's psyche if they're open to really open up about it, because the hero's journey is everything for me. So I love to see where people's own path has led them and what trials and tribulations have they faced. Have they come face to face with their dragon? Were they burnt by the dragon? Were they consumed by the dragon, or did they become the dragon themselves? And there's a lot of interesting takeaways that just from having a numerous amount of conversations regarding this. And I find it, I find it fascinating. And you brought it up just then as well, which is a slight tangent, but it's also something that I'm interested in myself, to do with, you got monogamy, you got serial monogamy, and then we go into the likes of being polyamorous. And how has that been for you, dude?
You know, it's been magical and challenging and growth inducing. When I first started identifying as poly, you know, when I became aware of it and I realized, like, okay, my identity is as a polyamorous person, I thought it would fix everything. You know, I had been very unfaithful to my wife in our marriage, and you know, nobody gets married. Nobody like stands in front of their friends and family and says beautiful words and pays, you know, $100,000 for a New York City wedding thinking, man, I can't wait to fuck this up. That's not what happened. But what happened is I, you know, allowed myself to believe that I could love my wife enough to fix the things inside me that needed to be addressed. And even though at the time I didn't know where a lot of them came from, I thought I had done a lot of the work, and there was this piece of me that was always challenged by monogamy. And I loved Negar so much that voice got turned down a lot, and that was okay for a while, but existing in it, and you know, it really it drove me in so many ways and pushed me, and I made a lot of very, very hurtful choices, and those choices are ones of which I'm not proud. And then when I realized that I was poly, I had mentally checked out of my marriage, and I was spending a lot of time here in New York City instead of California, where I'd lived with my wife. And, you know, we had this like distance-based separation, and I started another relationship with a woman with whom I fell in deep love. And, you know, it was very much like an affair, but for me, it felt like this is my real life. And this is this thing that this marriage is something I need to take care of eventually. And, that relationship with that woman was polyamorous, and it was open, and I learned so much and I grew so much, but I still fucked it up. I still had infidelity there because I went in, once again, I avoided the cave. I avoided going into the cave. And instead I was like, 'cause first I thought, okay, well, I'm so in love with this person that'll fix me. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, okay, no, but I'm poly now, and I'm going to live and identify as polyamorous, and that'll fix me. But nothing fixes you. You have to fix you. And so for me, firstly, accepting that I was poly, that it, I did make massive strides. I learned so much from that relationship. I learned so much from my marriage. I believe that there were many instances of pure failure on my part in my marriage. And I did not show up the way I would have wanted in it. And I hurt my wife so immensely. But I don't consider the marriage a failure in that I got so much out of it in terms of my growth and my self-development. And then the same with that subsequent relationship. But the thing I learned overall was that, like, no person can fix you no matter how much you love them. You can't love someone enough to change who you are. You can love someone enough to use that love as the reason, as the impetus to do the work and fix yourself. But you can't just love someone so much that you're not broken anymore, that you're not hurt anymore, whatever it is. And then the lesson that I learned with that subsequent relationship is that you can't just identify and live as poly and you know, because there's still shame, there's still cowardice, there's still feelings of fear around having hard conversations. And there is this idea that you're going to be abandoned. And so you push off your ideas of what you desire, what you want, you push them off and push them off and push them off. And then eventually you make a decision that isn't in line with the agreements of those relationships. And from there, you are now doing the same thing. And it's like, you know, when you're in an open relationship and you can have sexual encounters with other people, it's just a matter of having a conversation that forms the foundation for the relationship style itself. To me, when it says very clearly that doing that anyway is like, that's blowing up the relationship. That is finding more pain. That is creating more pain, because that keeps you from doing the thing that you know you need to do. And so polyamory for me has been a, it wasn't a fix. It was, it is my orientation, but just like you can be gay or bisexual and you can still be fucked up in your relationships, same thing here. And so accepting myself as poly was stepping up to, the next level of my development in terms of self-identification, and messing up my relationships the way I did were, that was, those were the inciting events that helped me see to, and I guess inciting events are call to adventure, to use Campbellian lexicography here. But so to use that parlance, those were the inciting events that helped me see that this is an area that I strongly need to address. This is an area where I have so much work to do because I can't, I don't always have to be redeeming myself. I don't always have to be on a redemption arc on some hero's journey. I don't always have to be proving to the world and myself that despite all the stuff I did in the past, I'm a good guy. I can just be a good guy. I can just do that. I can live that every day. But to do that, I had to first heal. I had to dig into the trauma. I had to examine what it is. I had to make amends. I had to really hold myself with grace and push through it. And I don't believe that I'll never make a mistake in my relationships again. But I do feel very confident that I will have the necessary conversations, because that is the commitment in my current relationships, where every day we have hard conversations, we talk, and I don't avoid things. And that is a habit that you build. You know, it's that you're sharpening that particular sword. And so polyamory has been an incredible tool for self-discovery. I don't recommend it to anyone for any particular reason. For the most important thing is that I like to really just help people understand, for me, it is not a lifestyle choice. If I could just magically wave a wand and be joyously fulfilled through monogamy, I'd do that. It's fewer personalities to manage. It's less travel. It's cheaper, the whole thing. But poly is what fulfills me. Freedom in that way is what fulfills me. Mm-hmm. And so it's my sexual orientation, my sexual alignment. It is as big a part as my sexual identity as identifying as a cis-hetero male. So my experience is net positive because it helped me understand myself and closed the doors on a lot of other things. And, you know, sometimes when your field gets narrower, it's much easier to move forward. And so I am very, very fulfilled in my current relationship and my partnership with Amanda and all of the surrounding relationships that I'm developing it's beautiful. It's hard. And like, but here's the thing, man, like being publicly poly and having, you know, people making jokes and calling you a cuck or what, like that shit is so small compared to, you know, like what somebody else thinks in terms of what it means about me and my masculinity, because my partner has sex with other men. Like it's so low on my radar compared to the work I had to do with overcoming my childhood rape, with accepting how much I hurt people that I love. Some asshole on the internet telling me that like I'm a bitch because somebody else fucks my woman as though she were my property. Like I just, that's the shit that it's so laughable to me. Like I can't be bothered. I just don't have the cognitive or emotional bandwidth to give a shit. So I hope that they, you know, but what has been interesting is having discussions from a place of compassion and saying like, I know it's not for you. It's fine. But you know, like here's a big thing that you have to understand. You can't. And then, by the way, if anyone's looking for a soundbite in terms of a really good guiding philosophy for your life, in terms of your interactions with other people, you can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. And when people have opinions about poly or monogamy or what it means to be in love, or how when you're in love you behave this way, as though the way that they want to behave is the way everyone should behave, like that's the kind of stuff that you just gotta like operationally ignore. So I appreciate you asking, taking it down this path. It's been great for me.
Yeah, I'm interested, dude. I'm really interested. Because when A few years ago, when I was in New Orleans, I went to a psychic, and I know what some people's perspectives are on that, but I'm quite a firm believer, and there was a lot of stuff that this psychic said that turned out to be pretty spot on, to be honest with you. And one of the things that the psychic said to me, he said that I'm polyamorous. Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't know what that meant. Like, I had never heard of that word. So I was about 20 at the time, and yeah, I never heard of what that meant. And then I know, for example, Aubrey Marcus from On It. Mm-hmm. He's quite a well-known advocate. Well, I'll say advocate. He's just open about being polyamorous. And I'm yet to know where my position lies in it. Like, I have no judgment at all. But I'm interested in, is there any traits, any that you find in amongst the polyamorous crowd that is quite consistent personality wise?
Yeah. I mean, a big thing is guilt and how it manifests for you, right? Because you have this feeling where you're sitting with a person whom you love very much, and you look at them and you think, you are an amazing person, and I want to be anywhere in the world other than with you right now. And then you feel shitty about it and you feel shame about it. There's nothing that I would say I would want everyone to do, except have honest conversations. And I think monogamy is great. I think as a spiritual practice, acknowledging, yes, I do want to sleep with other people, but I'm choosing not to do that because that allows us to prioritize the relationship in the way that feels authentic to us. That's beautiful. But avoiding those conversations, you know, like, one of the things that we have been socialized to believe is that when you fall in love with someone, when you find the one, then all desire for other people goes away. And so when you believe that operationally and then experientially you run up against desire for another person, you found the one, you've done the work, you won the princess, you got married, you did the thing. And you are now, you've been socialized to believe that you shouldn't ever be attracted to another person again. You shouldn't desire anyone else again. And then when you do, you feel shame about it. And part of the way that media, particularly books and movies and music, have conditioned us to exist within a monogamous paradigm is we tell each other and ourselves all of these lies. You know, it's really sort of, it seems very important that if you're only going to be with this person, if you've made that choice and you guys have made those choices together, it seems very important that we allow them to believe or force them to believe that you only want to be with that person, which is just not a realistic thing. And so I think that if there's one thing about monogamy I would add, there's nothing I would take away, that's fine, it is what it is. But if there's one thing about monogamous relationship I would add, it is I would add honest conversations about attraction to other people. Imagine if, like, because your partner is your best friend, right? And so if this person that you're with, that you live with, imagine if you could just say, God, like, I am just so attracted to Scarlett Johansson. I think she's just beautiful. There's something about her. I just, like, can you even imagine what kissing her would be like? To just have that conversation the way you would have with one of your best male friends, and to have them, but we don't do that because we think it's going to make them feel poorly. And it might. It might, because they've been socialized to feel badly if you're attracted to anyone else. But what I would say is that monogamous couples can grow, or monogamous dyads can grow, far more deeply in their connection to one another if you say, God, I really want to know what it's like to kiss Scarlett Johansson. And then your partner says, that's a scary thought for me. The idea of you kissing Scarlett fills me with fear. It fills me with discomfort. It fills me, like, what if you were to kiss her, and then what would happen to our lives? What would unravel? Would you love her, et cetera? But you can work through all that stuff, and then you can get to the point where she can say to you, like, yeah, I bet that would be really great for you. And that, you know, and I think you're amazing. And I think Scarlett would get a lot out of kissing you because you're a great guy, Chris. And wherever you can get, like, that, it doesn't, you don't have to get to the point where you're now, like, you know, swiping on Tinder together, looking for a third person to bring into your bedroom. Like, I don't think that everyone's going to get there. But to just be able to acknowledge with each other in honest conversation that there is an attraction to another person and that's something you're struggling with and that you trust this other person enough to hold that for you. And that's why I really, really think it's important to have a relationship coach. One of the biggest problems I see is that people wait until things are like really, really, really fucked up in their relationship to get some help and to find a relationship therapist. It's like, you know, any mechanic will tell you if you wait until your oil light comes on, it might be too late. Like you've really ground your gears. The engine is not running well. And it's the same. And then it's like when you can put the oil in, but the damage that has been done to the gears already might be irreparable. And so many people, they wait and they wait and they wait to seek help in their relationship. So the core of monogamy is that we spend so much of our lives trying to find this one person to be in this relationship. And then we make it one of the focal points, one of the foundational support pillars of our entire social, romantic, financial, and familial lives. It like exists in our lives. It's the most important relationship most of us will ever have. And we spend half our lives trying to find it and the other half trying to maintain it. Why would you wait until things are really messed up to get some help learning how to exist in it? There's a big difference between being good at dating and being good in a relationship. And so what I would really encourage people to do is if you're in a happy relationship right now, find a relationship coach. It doesn't have to be a therapist. It can be a therapist, but find a relationship coach and like learn about communication and read the right books, read them together, talk about the things that you do want and don't want. I'm going to just take a minute to just shout out a woman named Diana Mandel. It's just at Diana Mandel on Instagram, DianaMandell, who's fantastic. Whitney Miller, Aubrey Marcus's fiance, like, you know, people who, you know, Diana is not polyamorous. She's monogamously married. Whitney is polyamorous, but finding people who are great at helping people in existing relationships, existing happy relationships, develop their communication skills. That is the most important thing. It's like, you know, we don't, you know, if you're willing to hire a fitness coach, it's like, you know, you don't wait until the day before your contest to do that. You do it weeks and weeks and weeks and months out. So if you're engaged, if you're like thinking about getting engaged, I think that a couple hiring a relationship coach or therapist and like building a very strong foundation is one of the best investments they can ever make, because like, this is it, right? If you are monogamous and you want to get married, then I think you're going into that hoping that you only do it once, expecting to only do it once. And so why would you not spend a little time getting better at existing in that relationship? That to me is a very obvious thing. And so many of us miss that. And so I would add to monogamous relationships, honest conversation about attraction or desire for other people and learn how to sit with it and learn how to set it aside. So the biggest thing, and we're going to loop back to what I said at the beginning of the podcast, most people are operating from a place of lack of self-awareness about their lack of self-awareness. And when you go into a relationship, you're bringing that lack of self-awareness. You are responsible for 50% of everything that goes into that relationship. And if you're not aware that part of the way that we operate monogamously is by both buying into and sort of encouraging the lies that we agree to tell one another about monogamy and about desire, the lies that science very clearly says are not true for most people, then, you know, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to be self-aware. It's going to be hard to like let that down. So I think that whatever it is in your development right now, whether you want to be better in your relationships, whether you want to be better at showing up and cultivating capabilities so that you know how to exist in the world with great communication. You know, if that's the case, like I would be happy to work with you in terms of writing and communication and branding, whether you want to exist in the world as a stronger, more capable, healthier person, in which case working with a fitness coach is great. If you want to be able to exist in the world in terms of, you know, just being able to express yourself more artistically, work at finding someone to teach you music or art or whatever. But the best, the things that are going to serve you throughout your life, regardless of context, are the ability to communicate well, the ability to be honest with yourself, get to know yourself, and the courage to take the steps necessary to fix that which needs fixing. And that has been the single biggest lesson that I have managed this year to act on, even though I learned it over and over and over every year, at least once a year for a decade, and ran from it. So there are so many young men listening to this podcast, and I understand that this is going to be scary for you. And I get that, but I would encourage you to not do what I did, to not just put it in a box and run from it and ignore it, to go into that cave, confront the things that you need to confront, to start growing in a way that is going to let you be the person you really want to be. And that for me has made all the difference this year.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, John, that was sound, brother. I really enjoyed that one. And I respect your time as well. I've just looked up at the clock and we've gone over a little bit over the time that me and you agreed upon. And yeah, I'm going to tie this one in, but that was really insightful, dude. That was, yeah, your perspective on polyamory was really interesting to me. I still don't know what I necessarily think about it. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that, again, you can only really talk about from experience. And I think until you've experienced it firsthand, it's hard to really understand where you're coming from. Like I totally still enjoyed listening to what you're saying. And I think it's just so alien for some people because of the... Yeah, because of the social programming and just how we are, just how deeply entrenched and conditioned the that old paradigm, that old monogamous paradigm is within us. But I definitely, how, when you said that you found out that you're polyamorous, how did you find out you're polyamorous?
It was a lot of questioning and a lot of reading, and you know, the restraint, the mantle of monogamy had never sit lightly on my shoulders, and I always struggled with it. But then, you know, as my marriage was sort of collapsing in on itself, just meeting people who were poly and talking to them, but also going through and doing the reading, I just noticed a lot of stuff within myself that I was like, this is how I feel. Because it got to a point when, you know, I was going to a lot of therapy, and I was going to meetings about, you know, and it became a decision of identification, and I like, acknowledging who I really am made the decision easier, because it was like there are these two houses, and in this one house you're broken and you're wrong and this comes from trauma, or you're immature, or you have a fear of commitment, or you're just inherently selfish. And in this house it's beautiful and you can have great and successful relationships like that, and it is a very valid way to conduct your romantic and sexual and relational lives or life, and it is something to learn about, and it's a place to exist safely without judgment. And when it got down to it, it was just very clear. I didn't live in that first house anymore. I couldn't live there. I didn't belong there. That was not the house that I was made to live in. Mm-hmm. And so I packed my stuff and I moved up into the other house. And moving into that second house didn't mean that there were no growing pains. It didn't mean that I didn't occasionally freak out and put my fist through a wall, metaphorically. It meant that I was in a better place as a baseline of beginning to dig in and work toward self-knowledge, self-understanding, self-mastery, and eventually self-love. And that is a journey that you're on for your entire life. But for me, I feel so confident and so fulfilled knowing, just being here with you and saying that and knowing that it's true for me. And that's a big part of it. And I think it's, you know, some people find religion the same way. They just, when they get there, or love, it's when you know, you find something and you're like, okay, and this is for me. And so what I would say for anyone who is interested, there are a number of fantastic books on the subject about self-identification, about polyamorous relationships and their setup and how to govern them, about the history of monogamy and marriage and how it came about as a result of, you know, passing down property and ownership in an agrarian society. And also sort of the evolutionary biology that we all, you know, we are all the descendants of our ancestors. And so in terms of evolutionary biology, there's a lot of science there as well. And what I would say is, if you're interested, anyone listening to this, go to johnromanello.com/polybooks, all one word, polybooks. And that will just redirect you to an Amazon list I put together of all of my favorite resources on sex and relationships. But in particular, it will cover polyamory. So it's johnromanello.com/polybooks, all one word.
Yes, man. It's I've just been digesting everything you've been saying in this podcast. Normally I'm a lot more chatty, but I've been very focused on what you've been saying, and it's very interesting. And like you said, it's all about that cultivating the hero spirit to pursue self-mastery. And yeah, following your heart, following your bliss, whatever that is. And yeah, such an important message. And that, like, literally what you said, Campbell's quote is another quote that I live by, is the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. And that's so important. And that can be so different for so many people. Some people's dragons may be another person's bliss. So it's all, like you said, subjective to the individual. Yeah, man. John, I really enjoyed this one, brother. I kind of would have loved to have delved a little bit deeper into the darker caves, but maybe that's a discussion for another time. So just to close this one up, mate, I know you briefly mentioned it at the beginning of the podcast. For everyone that's interested in more about what you're about, could you give us a little bit of a bit of a plug? Where can they find you guys?
Absolutely. If you are on the social medias, my handle is just at John Romanello, JohnRomanello. I'm sure Chris will link it up wherever this is being listened to. So if you could do me a favor, if I could make a request, if you have listened to this and you enjoyed it, do me a favor and screenshot it and then write your biggest takeaway or the biggest thing that you hated and just post it to your Instagram stories with me and Chris tagged. I would love to engage in some dialogue. If there's anything that you want more information on, feel free to do the same or DM me and I can send you resources. So Instagram is the platform I use the most right now. So it's at John Romanello on Instagram. My personal site is johnromanello.com. And on that site, you can find everything from articles and essays about writing and business and branding to mental health. You'll also find links for how you could work with me in terms of whether it is business consulting, if you're trying to grow a big business, for coaching or I mean, anything. We've worked with everyone from people who have t-shirt companies to diamond businesses. But most importantly, if you are looking for how to find your voice, if you are looking for a way to create a very, like, a visceral, authentic personal brand that allows you to build income and revenue and influence and impact, talking about your favorite bands and your favorite foods and the things that you love and don't love, then you would definitely well served. You'd be well served by checking out some of the writing mentorships that I offer. They are in 3, 4, and 6 month blocks. We've got rolling admissions. So if anyone is listening to this and you slide into my DMs asking about a writing mentorship, just say you heard me on the podcast, and I will make sure that you get a discount code, and whatever it is that we're charging at that particular point, we will pick a number between 1 to 10, Chris.
7.
All right, we will give you a 7% discount, and then we will round down to the nearest logical number. So whatever that savings happens to be, it's likely to be a couple $100. So we are very, very excited to work with you. And by we, I mean my team and I. And so again, it's at John Romanello on everything. And I would love to know what you took out of this. So thank you. And thank you, Chris, for having me.
Yeah, for sure, dude. That was great. Quite some sales as well. Quite some pitch. Definitely got something to learn from you as well, John. That was, yeah, mate, really enjoyed that one. And right, let's tie this one up. So guys, that was deep. That was deep. Hopefully you enjoyed it. That was something different. It was a little bit of a different route than where I was originally planning on taking this podcast, but I'm happy that we went down here. Very spontaneous, very in the moment decision to kind of direct the conversation down this way. And I think I really like this one. And I think this is going to be something that I wasn't really preparing to present to you guys, but I think this is just as, if not more, beneficial, because this is a, like John said, it's a dragon lurking in the cave of many, within many psyches. And yeah, hopefully hopefully John has shined the light into that cage a little bit, into that cave a little bit, enabling you to, yeah, take a few steps in a little bit deeper before you take the complete plunge. So yeah, sound. Episode 55, guys. Over and out. Stay woke as fuck. And I'll catch you on the next episode.